Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Trying out my kung fu moves on Mark Brumley. Mark Brumley, our guest this hour. It's Ask Me Anything, 888-318-7884. Was that terrifying, that display of kung fu prowess that I just put on? Were you terrified?
No, because I had put my taekwondo mindset on.
Oh.
So when you did kung fu moves, I was prepared.
Yeah. You were going to use my energy against me?
I was. Yeah. I was going to do that. Yeah, I was going to get your chi, locate your chi,
yeah.
The center of your chi, and redirect the flow and... And do all those things.
Yep.
Because I grew up in the 70s like you. Well, 60s. I'm a little white.
No, I think we're about 64. I was born. What year were you born?
Oh, man. Before you.
You were?
How much?
But, oh, yeah. You look so good.
I'm
you look
ancient,
so good,
man.
Brumley.
Anyway.
So
it's all that clean living and listening to Catholic Answers, you know?
When I was a kid, I thought that Bruce Lee was virtually a superhero. I thought there was no one on earth who could defeat Bruce Lee in a fight.
That's probably was probably true.
Well, he weighed like 120 pounds or something. Know, he wasn't big.
I know.
So
well,
did you
do study martial arts at all?
No. Yeah. No. Not at all.
Okay.
No.
I
studied
My
running away.
We both did.
Oh, you did? You studied martial arts?
Yeah, we did.
Figured if I could, like, if I'd learn to run away, I'd be okay. You know, I just needed to be able to.
Well, you know, that's not a bad thing if you can do it.
Well, here's my
to avoid fighting, you know?
Yeah, this is my primary fighting skill. Watch this. I've mastered this. Look over there, and then I just run away. What do you think of that? I think that's pretty good. It's always worked.
I think we should talk about apologetics, but before we do that, did we talk about last time the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible coming out?
We did talk about that? But you lit a fire, and people are so fired up and excited. Talk to me about the Ignatius Study Bible.
So the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, Old and New Testament, you know, combined, single volume. It will be out in about a month. You can pre-order it now. You can go to your local Catholic bookstore and say, I got to have this before Christmas. Do that.
Okay.
Or you can go other places, you know, including our Ignatius website or catholic-study-bible.com. St. Paul Center is also... a place you can go for it. And Scott Hahn, of course, was the general editor and worked with Curtis Mitch on this. And it's been a quarter of a century in the making. We got it. The thing about it is it's solidly Catholic. It's a really good translation of the Bible, RSV Second Catholic Edition, solidly Catholic in its notes, essays, commentary. It's got lots of wonderful introductions and features, all that stuff that's just a given that you've got to do that if you want to be serious about Catholic scripture scholarship. But it's also got these wonderful footnotes and annotations and essays that help you understand the Bible. If you got questions about the Bible, this is a place to go. You don't have to be it's one of those things. I'm amazed, really, in a lot of ways. And of course, I was involved with this the whole time. But when you bring it all together, I'm still amazed that it's got stuff for the scholars, and it's got stuff for the mom and dad that just, you know, they just decided they're going to start to study the Bible, and maybe they're doing something with their parish, you know, with Ascension, Father Mike Schmitz, or Augustine Institute, or whatever, and they want to study the Bible, and, you know, all for those other Bibles, by the way. We're friends with those folks, and we distribute them, but this wonderful thing about the study Bible is it's accessible to mom and dad who just decided they want to start studying the Bible, and they can use it with these other Bibles and other programs. So we don't see it so much as competition as complement. It's complementary to what others are doing.
Now, is it realistic that someone could order it now in any of these places and give it as a gift on Christmas Day?
It is.
That's
thanks be to God that the dock workers strike.
Oh. Ended. Thank you, dock workers.
We were getting, you know, 15 reports a day. What's going on? Where's the boat? You know, and all that kind of stuff. So, yes.
All right. That's good. That's just perfect because I think it's just a fantastic gift. I'm considering it as one of the gifts I will give each of my adult children. So it's in that the running. It's in the running.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so. I'm gonna give it. I've already got about 10 people that I'm getting to. Give it to. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So go to Ignatius.com, all those other places that, please go to your local Catholic bookstore and ask for it, especially if you're in Boise, Idaho, where they have one of the best Catholic bookstores in the world, but anywhere. Did you know that? Boise,
absolutely.
Idaho has a fantastic Catholic bookstore?
I'm hearing things about Boise, Idaho, and it, not only the Catholic bookstore there, but the Catholic Renaissance.
Here's the thing about the people of Boise. They don't want you to tell anyone about it.
I know.
Because people will come there. Boise is... one of the, I have two cities in mind that are like these hidden gems of American cities, and Boise is one of them. And,
Yeah.
It's so beautiful there in Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
But they don't want you to tell anybody.
I know. We got friends that move there, and yeah.
Oh, you do.
But you know what? They need to evangelize the whole state and make it like a completely Catholic state. And then some of the rest of us can come up and maybe at least visit.
It should be a Catholic state. Do you know first of all, the Eucharist processed across Idaho, and they loved it. But do you know what the major religious group in Idaho is? Do you know?
I would think it might be Mormon, but I don't know.
Yep, it's Mormons. That's right. Yeah. People think of Utah as the Mormon state, but a lot of Mormons in beautiful, beautiful Idaho.
Well, we can engage in fruitful interreligious dialogue there.
Yeah.
We'll go there. We'll do that.
Right.
You and me, we'll go up there together.
I'll go on a mission if where I'm going is Idaho, as long as it's not in the winter or summer. As long as it's not winter or summer. I'm a very fragile missionary. Winter or summer or the really windy part of spring. Other than that, I'll go anytime. Not when it's raining in the fall, but any other time I will go to Idaho to be a missionary with you.
Excellent.
Are you impressed with my stalwartness?
I am. You always impress me, your stalwartness. And okay. I'm sure I would have loved your stalwartness at the Catholic Answers Conference. I'm sure that would have been just outstanding.
The Catholic Answers Conference was good. It was really good. A lot of great talks there. Liam's in Alberta, Canada. Do you want to talk to Liam?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's
talk to Liam in Alberta, Canada, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Liam, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Yes, I'm going to be casting my online ballot soon in the U.S. election. And I was wondering, for my fellow Catholics and other Christians, what should we take into consideration when picking who we vote for?
Every single American is like, what? You can cast an online ballot in an American election? We were not aware of that. Liam, what state do you vote in?
Montana.
Oh, Montana. Oh, all right. They have online voting in Montana. I didn't know that. Mark, help him out.
I didn't either. So what should you take into consideration? We should always take into consideration the basic principles of Catholic social teaching, which are basically the gospel, the revelation of God in the gospel applied to the social order. So the dignity of the human person, which includes all of the rights and responsibilities that flow from that, including the right to life and the right to a decent life and associated freedoms and responsibilities that come with that. The common good, so we don't just vote for our own particular interests. We vote for what's good for everybody, and good in the objective sense, according to human nature, human dignity, and the vocation of every human being to pursue and come to know God and to order his life consistent with the moral law. So that's the common good. Not just individuals, but all of us together. The fundamental unit of society is the family. So, it's often said, we often think about the dignity of the human person as implying that the individual is the foundation of society. Well, there's a sense in which that's true, but there's a sense in which it isn't. And more fundamentally, when we think of society as a group of people, it's a certain kind of group of people. And you say, what's the most fundamental unit of that? Well, it's really the family, because individuals come into existence through the family, right? So family is the most basic unit of society. And so we should vote for policies that support marriage and family life, and marriage understood as a union between one man and one woman, and family life, including the right to life for unborn children and all that goes into helping parents be able to fulfill their obligation, not only to have children, but to foster the well-being of those children, to educate them, and to allow them to grow in their faith. So we've talked about dignity of the human person, we talked about the common good, we talked about family as the basic building block of society. We can also talk about two other principles, the principle of solidarity, which basically says we're all in this together, so we should support the rights and the obligations. Rights always go with responsibilities, and responsibilities imply rights. So solidarity is that we're all in this together. We should not just look out for our own interests, but for the interests of other people. And we can know what that interest is when we look at human nature and human dignity and the rights that flow from that. It includes the right to property and to pursue work and work with dignity. And then subsidiarity, which is a principle that says we should support one another, and we support one another by fostering society through its laws and its institutions that allow and enable individuals and smaller groups to fulfill their responsibilities. And oftentimes that means organizations of a higher order, like the order of government, need to not dominate or control organizations or groups or individuals of a lower order. So we call that the principle of subsidiarity, and it's a form of assistance. So all these things taken together, we have responsibilities to our federal government as citizens, our national government, I should say. We have a responsibility to our state government and the political leaders and the laws that those governments pass, and we have obligations to our local communities. And all of those things apply: dignity of human person, common good, families, foundation for society, marriage between a man and woman, right to life, so on, solidarity and subsidiarity. So now I can't tell you how, well, I have my opinions on what's the best way to vote. This is a Catholic entity organization, so it's not here for partisan political positions, so I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but I can talk to you about principles and all kinds of issues with respect to those principles that touch on the ideas that we just mentioned.
Okay, Liam?
Yeah, the reason why I was asking is because originally I was just going to stay out of it, but then I felt like, every vote counts. So I'm just wondering what me and my other Christian brothers and sisters should take into consideration when going to the ballot and choosing their candidate.
So let me draw on a statement of the Lord that in its original context did not specifically apply to the issue of voting. But I think by extension, given the nature of representative and participatory government that we have today, I think it does apply. Jesus said to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to render unto God what is God's. And Caesar, there's a certain obligation that we have to Caesar. Caesar represents the civil order, the order of politics and so on. And so we owe obedience insofar as it doesn't contradict the law of God and promotes the good of others. We owe obedience to the laws of the land. But in a representative form of government where we as citizens have a right to vote, we owe participation in the civil order. So we owe our voting, and where we are competent and called to do so and circumstances allow, that includes even running for office. So we have that obligation. The other part of that where Jesus says, render unto God what is God's, we should call to mind the fact that God has allowed human beings to manage their own affairs. So just as you and I have an obligation to use our personal freedom in a way that's consistent with God's law, when we get together and we form communities, we together have an obligation to use our freedom and opportunity and our resources in ways that are consistent with God's law. So I think Jesus' statement, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's, I think in the instance of participating in the political order, both of those things apply, and there's a certain obligation we have. It may be the case that in a given race, you know, you might not have a candidate you feel that you can in conscience support. That's okay. You don't have to vote for any particular candidate if that's how you feel, but you should vote. You should take part in the political order, because we are all together part of, you know, the order of governing. We're citizens and have the right, and therefore they have the obligation to exercise our right to vote for the good of others, for the common good.
Liam, that takes us to the break. Thank you very much for the call. I hope that was helpful. I'm glad we got to talk about that a little bit as the election is coming up here in the United States. Mark Brumley is our guest, the president of Ignatius Press. We will be right back with more questions from Mark right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest, president of Ignatius Press. The exciting news out of Ignatius Press, they've always got exciting news. They've always got great stuff coming out. But I think, really, it is a special time with the Ignatius Study Bible out, many people ordering it. You can get yours over at Ignatius.com.
And can I mention one other thing that's exciting?
Yeah,
that I
please.
Didn't mention. I was going to mention it next month, Lord willing, but I decided to do it today.
It better be exciting, though.
We are publishing a book that Father Fessio did not want published.
What?
Father Fessio, the founder and editor of Ignatius Press, did not want this book published, but we published it anyway.
Is there some sort of dissension there that we should know about? Is something wrong at Ignatius Press? Are you all fighting with one another?
Well, he didn't want it published.
Oh, is it a Festschrift or something of that nature? Is that?
No, it's better. It's his biography, Father Fessio, California Black Robe.
Wow.
Written by Father Cornelius Buckley, his old chum and mentor. It is a biography of Father Fessio.
Oh,
just came out.
And Father Fessio just didn't want the truth coming out, huh?
Well, he wasn't enthusiastic about it, but we did it anyway.
Well, that's great. A biography of Father Fessio. Very, very good. I'm glad you got that.
So
I'm going to go back to the phones here, Mark. But
yeah, let's go back to the phones.
But before, we were talking about Boise, Idaho, and I said there's two cities in America that are hidden gems. And that's setting you up to ask me what's the other one. And you didn't ask me.
Yeah.
So, all right, here we go.
What's the other one?
Des Moines, Iowa. I love Des Moines, Iowa. It's such a great city. People should know about Des Moines, Iowa. They probably don't want you to come there either. But
Iowa is one of my favorite states because it's just north of the state I was born in, which is my favorite state, Missouri.
Yeah, and Darren's favorite state is Missouri too. He's always
good.
Yeah.
He's smart.
Yeah, the people from Missouri, they're like, "Oh, it's the greatest state in the world." I feel like there might be a little insecurity. In the way you all see.
Well, and the Augustine Institute just moved there, so.
Oh, that's right. They did
move to St. Louis, my hometown.
Up next,
anyway,
Nick.
We better move on.
In Anderson, California, watching on YouTube. Nick, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi, Mark. Hi. Okay, so I have a question. I'm part of a dialogue group,
and I ran into an issue here that I'm totally confused about with an Orthodox priest. He's telling me that they reject the Council of Carthage 418 and the canons from that council. And I know I'm pretty sure that we accept that council as authoritative. And I'm struggling to understand
It's not an ecumenical council, but much of the teaching has been received in other councils and other formal statements.
Okay. Okay, so one of the canons is that children dying without baptism are excluded from both the kingdom of heaven and eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the canon that I'm kind of wondering, was that received in Council of Nicaea and also Ephesus?
It wasn't received in Nicaea. The Council of Carthage, I think, is... Okay, now you're going to get me. I think it's like 418 or 419. It's
418.
After Nicaea. It's one of the Constantinople councils that incorporated some of its teaching. And you caught me. I'm not up on the details of this off the top of my head, but I can articulate the general principle. The general principle is that in order to experience the life of heaven, which is communion with God in the beatific vision, in the fullness of divine life, grace is needed. Grace is needed for us who commit actual sin. And grace is needed for those who have original sin, which is the absence of grace. It's a deprivation of grace due to the sin of our first parents, right? So whether we've committed actual sins and therefore are at enmity with God through those sins, or we simply lack what we need by virtue of creation and the implication of the effect on us of what other people did in their abuse of freedom, our first parents, we need grace. And so the way I think the church, the Catholic Church, has received that teaching and how it would understand that would be to say that everyone, in order to go to heaven, needs grace. And that would apply to babies as well. Now, the question is, the normal way we receive that grace is through incorporation into Christ through baptism, through the sacrament of baptism. But we know, in the case of adults who are capable of being baptized, that the grace of baptism, at least the sanctifying grace that's involved with baptism, not the call the baptismal seal, so on, but that grace can come through things like martyrdom, so the baptism of people who are not baptized but who die for the love of Christ, right? And baptism of blood, and then we talk about baptism of desire in the case of catechumens who intend to be baptized, but circumstances are such that they're not able to be baptized before they die. And more generally, the church understands that God's grace is operative and available to everybody. The grace of Christ is operative and available to everybody. And so the church says, well, that can apply to infants as well. God certainly isn't caught off guard by the death of an infant. So we would affirm the necessity of grace in order to go to heaven, as they say. But at the same time, we would say that it's possible for babies to receive the grace of Christ even outside of the sacrament of baptism.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Nick.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your answer.
Well, thank you for the call and for the question. Our guest is Mark Brumley. It's Ask Me Anything, and there's one line open right now, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Silas in New York, watching on YouTube. Hello, Silas. You got a question for Mark Brumley?
Yeah, I do. So I had a question about Nestorianism. So we see a growing number of people in outside of the church, like John MacArthur and James White and a number of other people who will, you know, even if they don't identify as Nestorian, they basically hold Nestorian beliefs. And as we know, Nestorianism kind of, splits the nature of God in half. It says Jesus is two different people. There's one person who's human and one person who's divine, as opposed to the natures. Obviously, there's two different natures, but they don't say that. They say that he's two different persons, and therefore Mary is only the mother of the human Jesus. And that clearly has implications on the Trinity. So my question was mostly, does the Catholic Church consider Nestorians to be true Christians, in the sense that somebody who's a Lutheran or somebody who's an Anglican that's baptized is outside of the faith, but they're still Christian?
All right, Silas, I'll tell you what, it's a great question, but you're going to have to wait through the break because the music started playing while you were asking the question. We'll be right back in a couple minutes, and we'll get an answer on the Nestorians from Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern.
On the next Beacon of Truth, sacraments, anointing of the sick, and soulful Psalm 20.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest. He's the president of Ignatius Press. And you are welcome to call with whatever question you'd like to ask about the Catholic faith. You're very welcome if you're not Catholic. Anybody can ask a question about the Catholic faith here. 888-318-7884. On the line is Silas in New York. Wants to know about Nestorianism. And particularly, are Nestorians thought of as Christians by Catholics? Mark Brumley?
Yeah, so I want to make a distinction. I think Silas, you're talking earlier, you mentioned some fairly well-known evangelical Protestants, and I wouldn't say that those folks are Nestorians. Certainly not in the sense that you described when you described Nestorianism as the view that there are two persons in Jesus Christ. I think sometimes Catholic apologists and others may take a statement that is often made by Protestants and interpret it as indicative of a Nestorian point of view, but I don't think it actually reflects Nestorianism proper. And that is, we often hear it said by evangelical Protestants that Mary is the mother of Christ, or the mother of Christ or the mother of Jesus, but she's not the mother of God. And the idea there that they're trying to convey is that that Mary is the mother of Jesus's human nature, which we would agree with. They don't see that, they're not thinking through the full implication that motherhood involves a relationship between persons. And the person of Jesus is the second person of the Blessed Trinity, is a divine person. And so therefore, it's appropriate to refer to Mary as the mother of God. Now, they don't fully embrace that, or if they agree with the principle of it, they think that use of that term is just problematic, is subject to misunderstanding, and so on, so they don't use it. But it's not because they think that there are two persons in Jesus of Nazareth, one divine and one human. They would say, no, there's a single person in Jesus, and that's a divine person. So I don't think it's appropriate to consider them Nestorians. But of course, I would say that Nestorianism, you know, is a form of Christianity. And there's, in recent years, there's been some, further ecumenical dialogue between churches of a Nestorian background and the Catholic Church, and some clarification and with respect to understanding what those churches believe about Jesus in a way that's more consistent with Orthodox small o, we'll say Orthodox Catholic teaching. It actually also corresponds to Orthodox big O teaching, since we agree on the incarnation, two natures of Christ, and so on. But you know, even on the more traditional understanding of Nestorianism, yeah, they would be Christians. They just would not be wholly Orthodox in their doctrine of the person of Christ.
Now, does that get at what you wanted, Silas?
Yep, that makes sense.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. Mark Brumley, our guest. Off to Pennsylvania we go. Lisa is in Pennsylvania listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Hello, Lisa. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Thank you for taking my question. We recently had a meeting of ministers at our church, and we were instructed by the Pastoral Associate that those are the Eastern Orthodox faiths that were not permitted to give them communion, but my understanding was that they were able to receive communion from us. So how do I explain that to them respectfully?
Well, this point of clarification, who was it that said they were not allowed?
Our pastoral associate.
Okay, so your pastoral associate. Okay. If you look at Catechism of the Catholic Church, Article 1401, it says the following. When in the ordinary's judgment, in this case it would be the bishop, a grave necessity arises, so it's got to be a serious reason to do this, Catholic ministers may give the sacraments of Eucharist, penance, and anointing of the sick to other Christians not in full communion with the Catholic Church or the conditions, who ask for them on their own, provided they give evidence of holding Catholic faith regarding the sacraments, which would be true of Orthodox Christians, and possess the required dispositions. Generally speaking, there is a kind of not an encouragement of what we call intercommunion on the subject, because on the Orthodox side, they've got problems with going to a Catholic church and receive communion. I mentioned Article 401. I should mention as well Article 399, which speaks specifically of the Eastern churches. It says the Eastern churches that are not in full communion with the Catholic Church celebrate the Eucharist with great love. So notice that it's affirming their doctrine. And then we have a quote here in the Catechism, which is from the Second Vatican Council. These churches, although separated from us, yet possess true sacraments. Above all, by apostolic succession, the priest of the Eucharist whereby they still join to us, they are still joined to us in closest intimacy. A certain communion in sacris, that means in sacred things, and so also in the Eucharist, given suitable circumstances and the approval of church authorities, is not merely possible but is encouraged. So you can point to these passages of Scripture, 1399, 1401. I think that your associate is right to not give the impression that willy-nilly communion should be given Orthodox people without due respect to that passage I just read in Article 1401. They've got to request it, and so on and so forth. And also due regard is usually required for what the members of those churches, what their church, the discipline of their churches is. But basically, on the, you're on solid grounds in terms of theological principle. So that's what I would say.
Okay, Lisa?
Yeah, okay. But the situation that would occur would be during a funeral or a wedding.
Right.
If they came up to communion, it's not, they're not dying, but they are permitted
well, no, but
to
that,
receive communion.
But that would be a serious circumstance, yeah. And if they're Orthodox, they affirm the belief, the same belief as the Catholic Church, and they're doing it on their own initiative. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
Did you take down those passages from the Catechism?
1399 and 1401.
Yep.
All right. Lisa.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you very much. McGivney's next from Hastings, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Welcome, McGivney. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. My question is, what is the Catholic view on freedom and determinism? I'm taking a philosophy course right now, and it's kind of confusing. The three views that the book presents is a hard determinist, libertarian, and compatibilist is the three options. I'm just trying to figure out which one of those is the Catholic view on freedom and determinism.
All right, so these are philosophical usages of these terms. So determinism is the view that there is no freedom, that what appear to be our choices are choices that are determined, usually in a philosophical context, it's going to be by the laws of physics and chemistry and the way we as organisms have developed in a stimuli that we receive in circumstances and the innate responses or even the acquired responses built in our human nature that come about. So that's the deterministic view. A libertarian view would say we have freedom. We can choose between goods and even choose between what is perceived as good and what is perceived as not good or evil. And while our libertarian freedom can be influenced by or affected by or even reduced or limited by certain circumstances, ordinarily we understand that human beings have the power to choose, which means that if I could choose A, I could choose non-A. And then compatibilist is the idea that somehow the relationship between what seems to be a determined set of factors and what looks like our freedom or our liberty to choose, that these are ultimately compatible or reconcilable. So those are kind of philosophical categories. From a theological perspective, we believe that God is the cause of human existence, human nature, and is the source of our freedom. It's a real freedom, but it is also somehow involved with God's creation. We affirm some forms of predestination that God is involved in bringing about in a way that's mysterious with human freedom what God wills to bring about. So there is divine initiative and divine activity, creation and grace, and yet there's also freedom, free human responsibility. If It's a question of salvation, that free human responsibility, while being free also has to involve grace. So it goes beyond simply the freedom we have as created beings made in God's image and likeness as persons, and it includes the action of God's grace. Beyond that, there are different theological views in the church. Some views are associated with the school of thought of St. Thomas, Thomism. Other views are associated with what's called Molinism, which goes back to a Jesuit theologian Molina. And then there are variations on that, on exactly how we are to understand how predestination, freedom, and grace work together. There are different explanations or accounts of this. So within that broad explanation I gave you about God's being the source of our power to choose, we having real freedom and culpability and responsibility and needing God's grace in order to attain heaven, within those very broad categories, there are different schools of thought that are regarded as orthodox. So we're on talking about this on two levels. One's on a philosophical level, one's on a theological level. The Catholic Church would reject determinism insofar as it denies that there's freedom. It would also reject libertarianism if it's understood in a radical sense that would say we're not affected by sin, our freedom is in no way limited or damaged by sin, or that freedom is such that we can freely choose grace without God's action or involvement or movement in our salvation. So a Catholic theological vision would reject libertarianism in that sense, but it would affirm that there is real freedom. And it would affirm a kind of compatibilism if by that we mean God's predestination and human freedom in some way have to be compatible so that God's action doesn't deny human freedom and human freedom doesn't enable us to attain heaven apart from God's grace. So that's an awful lot that I said in response to a fairly complex question. I don't know if you got any follow-up on that, McGivney, but I'm open to it.
I think that that was kind of what I was leaning towards, was the compatibilist viewpoint. So thank you so much for answering my question. So thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's just be clear. Compatibilist has a very specific meaning in a philosophical context. So when I'm saying that the Catholic understanding of the relationship between predestination and freedom and grace is akin to the compatibilist position, I'm not saying it is equal to that, because that's a philosophical term, and in the Catholic context, there are other things that come into play. But I think with that stipulation, I would concur with what you said.
And that will bring me to the break. Thank you, McGivney. We'll take a quick break, right back with more. Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN, Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's awful fun when Mark Brumley is here. I didn't even say the thing that I usually say about you today. I think I got a bit distracted, maybe by the early talk of Kung Fu and Bruce Lee.
Taekwondo.
And Taekwondo.
Bruce Lee, yeah.
Yeah. But you are the head of the most important publishing house in the Alpha Quadrant, and I apologize for having failed to say that thus far.
Yeah, no, I your apologies accepted,
thank
of course.
You. Gosh, Mark,
in the spirit, you are in gracious. The spirit of the gospel.
Oh, what a gracious, gracious person you are. All right, you got more questions to answer, Mark Brumley, and here we go.
All right.
Mark, this is another Mark, but he's in Los Angeles, California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Mark, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
I don't know how to structure it, but I was just wondering, if compared to the answer you gave it a couple of callers ago with regards to Jesus saying, render to Caesar unto Caesar what, and to God to what's unto God. And then I think you mentioned that God is the source of our creation and freedom. Prior to Jesus' life and death and resurrection, he went for 3 days in the whatever. I don't want to go into that detail, but his grace. Did man lack grace prior to Jesus' resurrection in terms of because there was communities, there was government, and there was police, is it our fallen nature that we're given the pass by saying render to unto Caesar what's unto Caesar, what's God to God? I just feel like there is something missing here, because we're all born, we're God's creatures. And we're from his creation. We got a freedom, our will, our fallen nature, all that. It's all designed by God, right?
Right. So, well, yes, of course.
Where's the history on that? I mean, where's the, prior to Jesus, did we lack grace that we were just annihilating each other? Or, you know, you hear about the Roman Empire, how ruthless they were, brutal. And the empire before that, Genghis Khan, blah, 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 Hitler, Stalin. Is it just blame it on our fallen nature, or God knows that this is how we're going to be saved? Did we lack grace? Well, were we bad neighbors to each other back in the day, you know, about 2,000, 3,000 years ago? Or
all right.
I just don't
understand. Well, I wouldn't give the impression that, with the coming of the grace of the gospel, which comes with the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus, that somehow grace is obviously not eliminated all sin in the world, or even all sin in the church, or even all sin in us. So sin is still possible. Nor should we give the impression that before the coming of Jesus, somehow God was absent from the world and everything was just totally wicked and entirely depraved. The story of salvation is God working with people even after the first human being sinned. God still worked to raise up a people, and he started with Abraham and he built up the nation of Israel. We don't want to imply that apart from that, God wasn't doing anything in the world. I think a careful reading of the Old Testament will show that even outside of Abraham's progeny and outside of Israel, that God was still God. God was working in certain ways. All those things are true, but what God was doing there was looking forward to and preparing people for the coming of Jesus in a kind of participation in the life of grace that Jesus's passion, death, and resurrection was to bring about. So there is a kind of anticipation of participation in grace that we now look back on and we participate in now. We don't simply anticipate, but we participate now in grace. And so there's a difference there. I do think that the revelation of God in the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Hebrew Bible, you know, and the revelation of God in the New Testament has contributed to civilization and culture and even moral formation. And of course, God is at work invisibly in those things, just as he's at work visibly and invisibly in and through the church. So to the extent that we say, yeah, there's civilization in the world today and recognition of things like human rights and respect for persons to the extent that that exists in the world, I think Christianity had a lot to do with that. And I think God's grace moving in the hearts and minds of man has contributed to that. So it's kind of, it's not an either or, it's a both and. There is both sin and elements of God's original goodness in creation, and there is grace and redemption, and that's both explicit in the form of the fullness of the Christian faith in the Catholic Church, and it's implicit and working toward full communion in the Catholic Church outside the visible structures of the church. All those things are at play.
Mark, I'm going to leave it there and hope that that was a helpful answer, because we're short on time now and a little long on calls. Mark, yeah. Brumley is our guest. Patrick is in South Carolina watching on YouTube. Welcome, Patrick. If you can be a little bit quick with your question, Mark will be able to get you an answer.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious what the synod of bishops that's going on in Rome right now. I was hoping you could explain like what that means, what it is, and yeah, that's kind of the main thing, what it means for the church and just for us as Catholics.
Right. So a synod in the church is a church meeting, usually of bishops, but it can also be a diocesan synod where you have bishops and other clergy and laity involved. The synod of bishops is an advisory body of selection of the world's bishops, not all of them. An ecumenical council would be all the world's bishops, all the world's Catholic bishops. A synod is a selection. A synod of bishops is a selection. And it's an advisory body to the Pope. Pope Francis has expanded the synod a bit by allowing some non-bishops, some priests and laity, to be able to have voting participation, not on a full level of the bishops, but some level of voting participation. But at the end of the day, it remains an advisory body, what we call a consultative, not a deliberative body. A consultative body is a body that someone in authority consults with, but isn't bound to follow what they recommend or what their consultation results in. A deliberative body is a body that has authority to deliberate and to issue a binding statement. And the Synod of Bishops is not a deliberative body, but it's a consultative advisory body to the Pope.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
All right, great. Let's see, we can get one more question in, Mark.
Sure.
It'll have to be very quick. Isabel in New Jersey, thank you for the call. Can you ask the question really quickly, and we'll get an answer if we can from Mark?
Yes, sure. Thanks for answering. I just had a question about Mary's power and authority and what the church teaches on that, because, like, other than God, who has power other than intercession? It doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. Does Mary have authority other than intercession, Mark?
Well, she has a spiritual authority, but it flows from her relationship with God. So that's sort of reducible to intercession, you know. She doesn't have authority. The only authority that Mary or anybody has in the church is whatever is granted by God. So
wow.
we shouldn't think of Mary as wielding some kind of independent spiritual status and, you know, checking in with God from time to time and asking for him to do things when her independent spiritual authority or power somehow isn't sufficient. No, everything that she has by virtue of her union with God. And in that way, in that sense, you can relate it to her intercessory power.
Isabel, I hope that that was helpful. You were very gracious to get the question out quickly so we could get an answer from Mark Brumley. Mark Brumley is the president of Ignatius Press. Check out the new Ignatius Study Bible. Did I say that right? Ignatius?
You did. Ignatius Catholic Study Bible.
Ignatius Catholic Study Bible at Ignatius.com. Also, the new biography of Father Fessio. He didn't want it, but it's out there. You can get it at Ignatius.com. Mark, thank you very much. I always enjoy the time with you.
Likewise. God bless you.
All right. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.